please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Indeed, most Western media outlets draw from a standard playbook, rather than digging deeper to find the truth and to challenge the Israeli regime statements. Reporters instead help the regime to shroud events in ambiguity. This double standard exposes the complicity of Western media in covering up Israeli crimes, says Abir Kopti, blogger and activist, in an article titled "Shirin Abu Aghla Killing: How Western Media Parrots Israeli Regime Propaganda." Stay tuned for more. All of Palestine has united in shock to mourn the killing of iconic Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghla by the Zionist regime. But amid their grief, they are forced to witness how Western media outlets yet again are failing them. When a Palestinian is killed by the Zionist regime forces, the act is always described in passive terms. Abir Kopti, blogger and activist, says, "We just die on our own. No one kills us. Sometimes we die as collateral damage in clashes, with no context given as to how the altercation broke out or the power imbalance at play." Then comes the automatic adoption of the Israeli regime talking points, which are always manipulative. The Zionist regime's strategy is to immediately deny responsibility, then to cast doubt on Palestinian testimonies, laying the groundwork for the assertion that there are two versions of the story. The media then repeats this uncritically. On the day Abu Aghla was executed, the reporter of BBC World Service parroted the Zionist regime talking point that she was killed by Palestinian gunfire, then noted that Palestinians had said she was killed by the Zionist regime fire. Most international media adopted the same lines, almost as though they had written their pieces collaboratively on a joint Google Doc, while being sure to air all of the Zionist regime's talking points. However, Western media failed to give the same consideration to the Palestinian side. Palestinians have every reason to distrust the fabricated regime of Israel, which habitually uses such investigations to bury cases. But Western media do not appear to care about this vital context. The skewed coverage continued even during Abu Aghla's funeral. after the Zionist regime forces attacked Palestinian mourners, with live footage showing a deliberate and unprovoked assault. Major news outlets disingenuously wrote about clashes erupting or violence breaking out. Indeed, most Western media outlets draw from a standard playbook. Rather than digging deeper to find the truth and to challenge the Zionist regime statements, reporters instead help the fabricated regime of Israel to shroud events in ambiguity. And no matter what comes next, even if the next story includes a line about the Palestinian response, the first impression has already been set. In Abu Aqila's case, little effort was needed to debunk the Zionist version of events. She was accompanied by several other journalists whose testimony aligned. They all said the same thing. Abu Aqila was targeted by an Israeli sniper. Unfortunately, it would seem that the words of Palestinian journalists are not sufficiently credible for Western media. Testimony from journalists such as Shata Hanaisha, who was next to Abu Aqila when she was killed, Ali Asamudi, who was also shot and wounded in the incident, and Mujahid Asadi, who also witnessed the killing, are not accepted without further validation from Israeli rights groups such as B'Tselem or news sources such as Haaretz. Even then, when the Western media can no longer avoid exposing the Zionist regime's lies, they may add a few lines to their stories here and there. But when the integrity of these stories is truly crucial, in the hours immediately following these types of events, reporters habitually stick to Zionist propaganda. This, in turn, sticks in the minds of the readers and viewers. When journalists are killed in other parts of the world, reports from Western media immediately cite the killing. This double standard exposes the complicity of Western media in covering up the Zionist regime's crimes. Ending this complicity would not require much. Just for international media to treat Palestinians, including journalists, with the respect they have earned. Communique.
Whenever people talk about the war in Ukraine, they tend to focus on what's happening inside Ukraine. You know, the battles taking place in Mariupol, the Donbass, or the outskirts of Kiev. But that's just half the story. The war in Ukraine is really a catalyst. It's pushing the world towards a multipolar order. Now, right this moment, we are seeing a global realignment. And I don't just mean the shifting of alliances. We're talking about the future of energy sales, global supply chains, the redistribution of power from the concentrated hands of a few in the West towards Asia. This is a seismic shift, both in size and nature, that could very well determine the future of international politics for the next decade. Now, if I told you 2 months ago that EU member states would be paying for their gas in rubles, you would never have believed me. And yet here we are, where the dominance of the US dollar, of the euro, are being challenged. And while the Western press want you to believe that the whole world is united and has the exact same position on Russia, it couldn't be further from the truth. So maybe it really is time to take a hard look at what the so-called international community really means and where it's headed. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The United States of America has been the global superpower during the 21st century up until this point, and for the better part of the last century. And one of the things that the U.S. derives much of its power from is its currency, the U.S. dollar. So toward the end of World War II in 1944, you had the Bretton Woods system that was put in place, pegging the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. And as a result, the U.S. dollar de facto became the global reserve currency. And that lasted for a few decades, right? And then from 1968 to 1973, that system fell apart. And what emerged soon thereafter in its place was the petrodollar. The United States, in secret, made an agreement with Saudi Arabia, right? They told the Saudis, we'll give you weapons, we'll give you security. And in exchange, the Saudis would conduct all oil sales in U.S. dollars and buy up U.S. bonds. 80% of all oil transactions are conducted in U.S. dollars. Around 55% of global reserves are in U.S. dollars. But now, because of the war in Ukraine, that could very well change. We've had several shocking developments in the last week that you would have never imagined before, right? So because of the war in Ukraine, the U.S., the EU, they have slapped Russia with sanctions to the point that Russia is now the most sanctioned country on earth with well over 5,530 sanctions. The EU sanctioned everything except Russian energy imports, because the EU relies on Russia, right? About 40% of their gas comes from Russia. However, the UK, the US, they went ahead and straight up banned Russian energy imports. And even though the US isn't a major importer of Russian oil, that announcement of, oh, we're thinking about banning Russian oil, and then actually banning Russian oil, this caused gas prices and oil prices to skyrocket. Oil went up to around $135 a barrel. That's the highest we've seen since July 2008. Gas prices also went up dramatically, Dutch and British. And now all of a sudden, the U.S. is panicking because the U.S. is a net importer of oil. So their oil bill is going way up. And so in order to drive the price back down, the Americans are trying several things, right? First of all, they called up the Saudis and the Emiratis and asked them, please produce more oil. We need to calm global prices. But turns out, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, he won't even take Joe Biden's phone call. You know, apparently they're unhappy because the United States isn't giving them enough support to kill more Yemenis. Then the United States sent a delegation to Venezuela. Remember, Venezuela sits on the world's largest reserves of oil. And the U.S. used to be one of their top customers, you know, until Bush, Obama, Trump sanctioned them into oblivion. Now, what's funny here is that for years we've been hearing from the U.S. and their allies that Nicolas Maduro is not the president of Venezuela. Apparently, the president is some guy that no one's ever heard of in Venezuela called Juan Guaido. But now, all of a sudden, when the Americans need oil, oh, now they recognize who's the real president, and they're sending a delegation to beg for oil. And again, who are they talking to? Who's the decision maker? Well, I can tell you it's not Juan Guaido, because they went to speak to none other than Maduro. Now, if the Americans are begging Venezuela for oil and begging Maduro for oil, you know the situation is dire. And on top of that, the Americans have tried other ways to bring down oil prices, right? So all of a sudden, after dragging their feet for well over a year, all of a sudden the U.S. wants to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Wow. So remember, the idea is that they lift sanctions on Iran. Iran can put its oil back on the global market, and then oil prices go down because the supply is increased. Well, that didn't happen because of multiple reasons. Russia demanded a written guarantee that Iran won't be hit with fresh sanctions for maintaining ties with Russia. However, it's also been reported there are additional details that had to be ironed out, the terrorism designations and so on. The point is, this sudden enthusiasm and this rush from the Americans to finish up the deal, it really shows their desperation. In the United States, they've basically sanctioned so many people, they've sanctioned everyone, that they've backed themselves into a corner. And who has the upper hand now? Russia, Iran, Venezuela. Let me tell you, that is quite the twist, right? You're really seeing the tables turn right before you. And to make matters worse for Washington, Saudi Arabia not only refused to take their calls, but was even contemplating selling oil to China, not in US dollars, but in yuan, in China's currency, the renminbi. So basically saying, bye-bye, petrodollar. Remember, the entire premise behind the greenback's value is that major oil sales, energy sales, are denominated in US dollars. Now, China imported roughly 17% of its oil from Saudi Arabia in 2021, so this is no joke. At the same time, instead of sanctioning Russia like everybody else, New Delhi struck a deal with Moscow for 3 million barrels of crude. Now, the amount is irrelevant because India consumes more than that in a single day. But the fact that India traded with Russia, continued to maintain ties with Russia, bought this oil at a discount and in rupees, rubles, so dealing another blow to the US dollar. So China refuses to sanction Russia. India and Pakistan refuse to sanction Russia. They're continuing to buy gas and oil like normal, right? Despite the threats to India that it will also face sanctions. That doesn't sound very isolating, right? That's roughly 40% of the world's population there, refusing to toe the Western narrative, refusing to toe the Western line, I should say. And never mind all the other countries that have also refused to condemn Russia. Just look at this map of who has sanctioned Russia. It's basically EU member states, North America, and Japan, and Australia. So in other words, it's the global north, right? This is where all the world's wealth is hoarded. And, you know, all the countries that have not sanctioned Russia are mostly countries you would consider the global south, right? So there's an interesting pattern right there. Western governments and media, they keep saying the international community is united against Russia. I'm sorry, that's not what it looks like. The West is not the international community. It's the West, or the global north, if you want to use the new terms, right? So as a matter of fact, it goes further than that. Let's look at these two UN votes. On March 2nd, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution condemning Russia. The overwhelming majority of countries did vote to condemn Russia. That's undeniable. But if you look at who abstained, we have Iran, Iraq, China, India, Pakistan, South Africa. Again, that is enormous. That's well over a third of the world's population, you know, above 40%. We're nearing half the world's population. And so later on March 24th, another General Assembly resolution and pretty much the same result. And 2 days before that, on March 22nd, you had a meeting in Moscow between the Russian foreign minister and who? The ambassadors of all the emerging economic powers, the BRICS, right? So you've got the ambassadors of Brazil, India, China, South Africa, meeting in Moscow with Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister. Again, that doesn't really look very isolating to me, does it? So you've got the two most populous countries on Earth, two nuclear powers, meeting in Russia's capital with Lavrov. I bet you didn't hear about that on the BBC. Now, Lavrov actually made his first visit to China since the war began. Just a week later, on March 30th, Lavrov actually visited India on April 1st. And now, India has received many visits, many official visits in the past week. You've had officials from the UK, from Greece, Austria, Mexico. They've all come to India. But the only one that India's Prime Minister Modi met with was Lavrov. And again, that pretty much tells you everything you need to know. But this war in Ukraine hasn't been without its setbacks, right? When we talk about a global realignment, that goes both ways. And so we've seen the European Union openly arming Ukraine. That's unprecedented. Germany, the same thing, right? Germany is broken with its past, with its stated stance of neutrality. And Germany's going even further. It's rearming. And I think this is something that not a lot of people really grasp. They don't understand how serious this is, that Germany is rearming. That never ends up well. The last time Germany rearmed, we had a Second World War, we had the Holocaust, we had 30 million dead in Europe alone. And now Germany is basically doing what Donald Trump wanted it to do, what NATO wanted it to do, which is increase their defense spending from 1.5 to 2% of their GDP. So Germany's announced 100 billion euros for its military. That's more than Russia. This is incredible, and it could have very, very severe repercussions down the road. Now, as soon as the war started, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan went to Moscow. He not only met with Putin, he also bought 2 million tons of gas and wheat. He refused to condemn Russia at the UN. He refused to sanction Putin. And the Americans took offense to that, right? Because they want countries they can control. And so soon thereafter, Imran Khan unveiled a plot by the United States to oust him, to unseat him from power. Lo and behold, here we are, and Imran Khan has just been ousted via a vote of no confidence. And like all Pakistani prime ministers before him, he didn't get to complete his 5-year term. The Americans are like the mafia, they don't forget, and they punished Imran Khan for daring to conduct an independent foreign policy. And that's the grim reality, right? That shifting towards a multipolar world doesn't come without a price, and the American empire will kick and scream and take down as many with it as it can. To punish Russia, we've seen many corporations pulling out, from McDonald's to Instagram, you name it. And among those are credit card giants Visa and MasterCard, which is actually not that smart when you think about it, because what they've basically done is they handed their market share in Russia to China, right? Because as soon as they left, China's UnionPay came into Russia and linked up with Russia's payment system, Mir, M-I-R. And to make things even more interesting, while all this was happening, Iran and Venezuela started talks to link their payment systems to Russia's Mir. So, you know, further enlarging the cooperation, the international cooperation between these countries, further enhancing the economic ties between the axis of resistance, between the global south. So the West attempts to crush Russia's financial system, you know, by freezing roughly half of the Russian central bank's foreign assets. They haven't entirely succeeded, because as a matter of fact, if you look right now at the value of the Russian ruble, it's regained a lot of its value. It's almost back to pre-war levels at 80 rubles to the dollar. And of course, there are people who say, well, this is just artificial, it's just temporary. Yeah, but it's still astounding. You know, Russian President Vladimir Putin told the Russian central bank, and he told Gazprom, the state-owned gas company, to come up with a plan by March 31st to make sure that all gas payments from unfriendly countries be conducted in rubles, not euros or dollars. And again, this is a monumental shift, because as we were saying, most oil and energy transactions are denominated in US dollars. Actually, most of Russia's gas sales to Europe are in euros. And so when Putin says unfriendly countries, he's talking mostly about the EU, the US, Japan, Norway, the countries that sanctioned Russia. And that alone helped shore up the value of the ruble, as European countries, which again, collectively, they get 40% of their gas from Russia. So, you know, they have no choice. They have to go now to Gazprom Bank and open an account in rubles, where their euros will be taken, they'll be sold for rubles in their name at the Moscow Stock Exchange, and then pay for the gas, then also used to pay for the gas in their name. So not only does that drive up the demand for rubles, but it's also smart because it means European buyers are now opening accounts at a Russian bank and not the other way around. So this further insulates both the money itself by keeping it in Russia and Gazprom Bank from potential sanctions in the future. And Joe Biden, the US president, he made clear that there will be food shortages as a result of the conflict. Benchmark gas prices have gone through the roof. People in the US are paying $4 a gallon now. And yes, there was already an energy and fuel crisis before the war. But the Americans and the Europeans have essentially taken a bad situation and made it three times worse. Don't go anywhere. We'll continue breaking down the shift to a multipolar world right after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So as we were looking at the other week in Yemen, when the price of fuel goes up, everything goes up, because fuel is one of the most important commodities and affects everything from healthcare to public transport to groceries. Now, earlier I spoke to Scott Ritter about his take on things. Scott is a former intelligence officer in the US Marine Corps. He also served as a United Nations weapons inspector and offers formidable insight, not just in combat-related matters, but international affairs and what it means exactly, you know, transitioning to a multipolar world.
The war in Ukraine is it's a cleansing moment, and that I don't mean that in a good way. You know, it's like you know, let's say you have a forest that's full of trees that are infected with you know, with fungus and insects and all that, and then you have a forest fire come through and burn it all down. That's not necessarily a good thing, except that what emerges in the aftermath of that fire is a viable forest with healthy trees that'll grow better and produce, you know, have a better impact on the environment. What existed prior was just a festering cesspool of, you know, of infection. The world today is a festering cesspool of infection because of the United States, because of our efforts to impose unilateral hegemony over the world. Ukraine, you know, you can't make the transition from that to what Russia and China are seeking to do without a forest fire. And Ukraine is that forest fire. And it's sad for the Ukrainian people. It's sad for the world. But I think that, for instance, Russia's economic addiction to the West is being broken because of this. The impetus necessary to get Russia to make the strategic pivot away from the West to China and Eurasia is only happening because of this. The liberation of the Russian government from the economic infection of Western you know, influence and the role played by the oligarchs. This is a cleansing moment. There is going to be a radical realignment of centers of gravity in the world. The singular polarity that exists is being broken apart, and it's going to be spread out. And BRICS is probably the initial model of where these centers of gravity are going to, the new centers of gravity are going to emerge.
So, you know, the Russians have demanded that quote unquote unfriendly countries start paying for gas in rubles, right? So Hungary, they've just announced that they will follow, they will comply. And they're effectively breaking ranks with the EU in saying that. Do you think there's going to be a domino effect? Do you think that other countries will follow suit?
Absolutely. They have no choice. Austria. How does Austria think it's going to get its gas? Austria is going to be paying in rubles. The Vatican is going to be paying in rubles. Slovakia is going to be paying in rubles. And Germany is going to be paying in rubles. They claim they're not going to be, but when the economic reality of what's about to happen to Germany hits home, and I would be willing to put money on the fact that Scholz won't survive the year.
Well, how long do you think that people in the West will tolerate these conditions, you know, higher gas prices, higher food prices, you know, just for the sake of what's being sold in the media as, oh, we're projecting European values and Western values? I mean, how long do you think this is going to go on for? Do you think, you know, there will come a breaking point, or do you think the media are so good at propagandizing people that everyone's just going to tolerate it?
You know, the media works when people come home and they have heat, they have food, and they have comfort. The media doesn't work when you come home and you're cold and you're hungry and you're uncomfortable. There's no amount of propaganda that can change those realities. And the, you know, how long is this going to last until the next election? It's over. There's not a single democracy that will have its current government survive the next election if this policy stays in place and their and the economies of that country tank. No government will survive a tanking economy. None. Now, in the United States, we don't have a parliamentarian system. So it's pretty much accepted right now that the Congress, that we have a midterm election coming up in November, and that the Republicans are going to gain control of Congress because the Democrats can't spin this. No matter how much Americans claim they support the Ukrainians, at the end of the day, high gas prices, high food prices are going to basically dictate that the government in power has failed.
So Russia have pegged the ruble to gold. What do you make of that?
Russia has done something very clever. I mean, how many people before this crisis thought that that Putin would link the ruble to the gold standard? But it happened, and it was a genius move. Because now the ruble, believe it or not, is dictating it, because the price of gold used to be linked to the dollar. I mean, you know, it's all based upon the dollar. But now by saying that I think it's 5,000 rubles are worth a half a gram of gold or something like that, that value doesn't change. At the end of the day, 5,000 rubles are worth this much gold. And so now it's the dollar that is linked to the ruble, and he's flipped the script. And again, this isn't a temporary measure designed to, if there hadn't been the divorce of the economies, then I would say there's a chance that this is just games. But there's been the divorce of the economy, so there's literally no impetus, no reason for Russia to play temporary games, because they're not going back to the dollar. They're not going back to the euro. They're not going back to the way things were. They're starting anew. This is about empowering the ruble to function in a trans-Eurasian market, not in an American market, not in a European market, but in a trans-Eurasian market as part and parcel of a currency flux that includes the yuan, the rupee, and other currencies as co-equal currencies of joint, you know, that can be jointly traded. No, Russia, this is the new reality.
You know, let's be clear. This isn't like sanctioning Syria or Iran or Venezuela. The U.S. and the EU, they're so used to bullying smaller countries with zero consequences. But this time, the sanctions go both ways. You know, these bureaucrats in Brussels, they're ready to hurt their own people just to spite Russia. But of course, it's okay for them because they're not the ones who are going to lose their jobs or feel the bite of higher gas prices and food prices. Russia isn't an economic giant like the United States, but it does play a strategic role, and it supplies a good chunk of Europe's gas. You can't just go, yeah, we're going to punish the Russians and forget about it. The ripple effect is going to be enormous. And the West have really shot themselves in the foot, right? Sure, they think they're punishing Russia in the short term, but in the long term, they've helped to speed up the process of de-dollarization and the emergence of a stronger Asia. You know, the West are basically begging Russia and China to find alternatives to SWIFT, to conduct oil and gas sales in denominations other than the US dollar, so either in rupees, rubles, or renminbi. Just to give you another example, on April 8th, China began buying coal and oil from Russia in renminbi. Again, the West are pushing Russia into China's arms and encouraging the global South to break free of the Western financial and monetary system, and proving just how important China's Belt and Road Initiative and greater Eurasia will be in the future. It's astonishing how the war in Ukraine has led to so many changes on a global scale and sped up the transition to a multipolar world, undermining U.S. hegemony in the process. Now again, no one is saying at the flick of a switch, we're gonna wake up tomorrow and find a multipolar world, but things certainly appear to be shifting in that direction at a faster pace than ever before. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The astronomical level of student debt accrued in the United States is inflicting lasting generational damage on the lives of millions of Americans. More than 45 million Americans are now carrying more than $1.7 trillion worth of debt, most of it owed to the federal government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The article has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled Student Debt is Crushing. Cancelling it for everyone is still a bad idea. The astronomical level of student debt accrued in the United States is inflicting lasting generational damage on the lives of millions of Americans. More than 45 million Americans are now carrying more than $1.7 trillion worth of debt, most of it owed to the federal government. The burden of that debt is crushing and follows borrowers throughout their lives. It is delaying marriage and home buying and the birth of children. It leaves some students broke on the day after graduation. Others labor for years only to find their balances larger than when they graduated. Lower-income students who must borrow heavily to obtain that degree can end up earning middle-class incomes without being able to lead middle-class lives. Around 40% of borrowers never graduate from school in the first place, and a third of the debt will never be paid off, according to the U.S. Department of Education. The Biden administration should spend its finite resources and political capital on fixing the higher education system in America to make it more affordable while helping those borrowers in most distress. There are already ways to do this, although they have not gotten nearly enough attention or resources. Cancelling student debt across the board is not one of them. Trying to fix such a shattered system with the flick of a pen on an executive order could even make it worse. Cancelling this student debt, even in the limited amounts that the White House is considering, would set a bad precedent and do nothing to change the fact that future students will graduate with yet more debt, along with the blind hope of another future amnesty. Such a move is legally dubious, economically unsound, politically fraught, and educationally problematic. As a candidate, Joe Biden said he supported congressional action to tackle student debt. Legal experts disagree about whether the president has the authority to cancel student loan debt through an executive order, as the White House is now considering. That raises the possibility that this issue could be dragged out in the courts of law for years. All told, 79 million American adults have had student loans at some point in their lives. Nearly half have paid them off entirely. Waiving $10,000 in student debt, the amount that Joe Biden proposed during his presidential campaign, could clear the books of as many as 15 million of the more than 45 million Americans who still owe borrowed money for school. Proponents of debt cancellation argue that Democrats need to deliver on a campaign promise to a key constituency, and it may well be politically advantageous for them to do so before the midterm elections in November, when turnout of the Democratic base will be critical to the party's success. But if the Biden administration puts forward a plan that voters do not regard as fair, the party could face a backlash at the polls. Since Joe Biden took office, his Department of Education has taken several important steps to alleviate some of the burden of loans for borrowers who are unable to pay and forgiven the debts of some students defrauded by for-profit schools. Throughout the pandemic, borrowers have been forgiven the interest that accrued on their loans each month, in addition to not having to pay down the principal value of the loan. The Biden administration has extended the pause several times, and it is now set to expire on 31st of August. the moratorium on payment of federal loans, which make up more than 90% of all student debt, has already cost $100 billion and has cancelled the equivalent of $5,500 in debt per borrower. The White House is considering various proposals for debt cancellation, possibly with income-based limits for eligibility. Such limits are crucial because they direct the help to those most in need. An across-the-board cancellation would be tremendously regressive, according to an analysis by the Brookings Institution. Most debt is held by higher-income households, and so any amount of universal forgiveness will benefit them disproportionately. In fact, the growth of student debt for graduate school, held by students whose degrees will offer them the greatest future earning potential, is a major driver of overall student debt. Graduate students account for some 37% of all federal student debt, and there is a lucrative return on investment for getting certain advanced degrees. Federal repayment plans adjust monthly payments based on income and family size and extend repayment periods. Debts are eligible for forgiveness after 10, 20, or 25 years of payments. Around 30% of all borrowers with federal loans are in such a program, and more borrowers could benefit from participating in one. But the repayment programs have a poor track record. Not long ago, fully 98% of people who applied to have their debts waived had their claims rejected. A report from the Government Accountability Office, GAO, in March found that millions of dollars in student debt could already have been forgiven if the programs had been administered properly. Richard Cordray, the Chief Operating Officer at Federal Student Aid, an Education Department agency, called the failure really inexcusable. The Education Department has been working to fix these programs by retroactively giving qualified borrowers more credit for time spent in public service and hoeing through a backlog of paperwork, but it could do more. Additional changes to income-based repayment programs, such as reducing interest payments, lowering eligibility standards, and exempting forgiven student loan debts from taxation, could have big impacts over time, according to a report from the Pew Research Center. Congress and the Education Department should look to such changes as part of a more sustainable solution to the debt problem. Lawmakers should also consider making it easier to discharge student loans through bankruptcy, a measure of relief that is available for credit card and mortgage debt. Changes to bankruptcy law in 2005 have also made those protections less accessible. The Education Department has started a long overdue crackdown on predatory schools, another significant source of student debt defaults. The Obama administration tightened the rules on for-profit schools, but the Trump administration's Education Department, under Betsy DeVos, relaxed those rules and let repayment and forgiveness programs atrophy. Last month, the Department of Education discharged $238 million in debt held by 28,000 people who attended the Marinello Schools of Beauty, which closed in 2016. The school engaged in pervasive and widespread misconduct, a Department of Education investigation has found. Since 2021, the Biden administration has approved more than $18.5 billion in loan discharges for more than 750,000 borrowers, including $6.8 billion for 113,000 people in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, and $8.5 billion for more than 400,000 borrowers with total and permanent disabilities. The Biden administration is also pushing to double the maximum Pell Grant and restore a rule that holds schools accountable for the gainful employment of their graduates, a measure aimed at for-profit colleges. Those moves are all to the good, addressing the student debt crisis with policies that are both compassionate and fair. They will not, however, solve structural inequalities like the racial wealth gap. Supporters of the debt forgiveness argue that targeted relief is inadequate and that broader relief would help to close the racial wealth gap. Black college students, on average, owe $25,000 more than their white peers. More than half of black borrowers report that their net worth is less than the balance of their student loans. And black borrowers are most likely than their white peers to drop out of school before receiving a university degree. But across the board, debt forgiveness will not help. As a recent report from the Brookings Institution concluded, only targeted policies based on race or socioeconomic status can address the inequalities, inequities caused by federal student lending programs. While inflated college tuitions are part of the reason for the rise in student debt, average student debt is now up to $36,800 from $24,700 a decade ago. It bears nothing that the number of students receiving loans to attend college has also increased. In other words, American students keep borrowing to attend college because a degree still offers the promise of prosperity. The Biden administration should focus on confronting the problems with college affordability and loan repayment, so more students and more graduates have a better chance at that prosperity.
Welcome back to Aperture. We looked into the life of Muhammad Iqbal from his birthplace in Punjab province of British India, now in Pakistan, to his academic studies in the University of Cambridge. Iqbal was a very learned man who was known for his political ideologies and philosophical theories. He is fondly remembered as a great poet and scholar. The political content of Muhammad Iqbal's poetry is one of the most fascinating aspects of his work. Except for a few poems, his entire poetic endeavor is tinged with the political concerns of his time. Both domestic and international political events shaped his poetry. He not only responded to political events in his verse, but also inspired his fellow Indian Muslims through his poetry to find a way out of the political dilemma in which the British colonial rule had put them. Stay with us as we looked into how Iqbal helped his fellow Indian Muslims aspire to a better future and guided them on the road to freedom.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the Royal Falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
شاعری کے مختلف ادوار ہیں مثلا ابتدائیہ جو شاعری ہے
علامہ's poetry consists of certain periods his poetry was at first as the poetry of the day
جو وقت گزرتا گیا اصل میں تو ان کی شاعری
he would say at that time my urdu poems are like a building made of clay
جیسے گارے کی عمارت بنانا
Little by little, his Persian poems came into existence. Among the first Persian poems were the familiar secrets and the mysteries of rapture. Such poems end with Javed Name, or perhaps with What Can Be Done, O Eastern People.
Gradually, Iqbal changes from a national poet to the poet of the Islamic world. His versified story, The Familiar Secrets and the Mysteries of Rapture, is first translated into English by Reynold Nicholson and published in the region. Years later, his Javedname is translated into German and Turkish in 1957 by those who study Islam, including Anna Marie Schimmel. The book is published in Munich, Hermann Hesse. The German writer and a winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature writes an introduction to Javedname, as requested by the translator. Hesse writes, Sir Muhammad Iqbal belongs to three intellectual domains. His works are the outcome of these three intellectual domains, Indian intellectual domain, spiritual domain, and Western Thoughts Domain.
There are three groups of Persian poets. The first, those who are absolutely meaning-oriented.
Iqbal, as a poet, is highly accomplished. He has bridged the gap between wisdom and heart.
The second, those who are pedantic. Meaning is absent in their poems. They pay attention to words and nothing more.
His poems touch the reader's sensations. Because they are so meaningful and precede even the thoughts forming in their minds.
The third, those whose poems are full of both words and meanings. From among them, we can name Hafez and Saadi.
Such senses calm mind, imagination, and consequently heart. This is a rare attribute seen in such great poets as Hafez and Rumi. The attribute is common in all Iqbal's poems.
Allama Iqbal has mastery not only over words, but also over various meanings, meanings which come out of him and are derived from his thoughts. His meaning-oriented poems outnumber his other types of poems, just as Rumi's. Iqbal says, There is no comparison between the melody and me. Speaking is only a pretext. I am pulling the camel, which has no rein.
Allama Iqbal, with a faith in Islam and a reasonable Gnostic faith indicating his deep certitude in God's sovereignty, moves his mind to search for secrets and mysteries of the creation. In his Islamic Gnostic poems and such verified stories as The Souvenir of Hijaz, The Eastern Message, The Familiar Secrets, and The Mysteries of Rapture, he talks about the principles of internal ontology of things, an idealization of the existential world. While his thoughts are at the height of their powers, he invites Muslims to solidify familiar philosophy exactly in accordance to monotheism, to bring about a new perspective, a new worldview, into the Islamic world.
So many memories are related to this house. My father came to live in this house when he was 11. Now, what sort of memory do you want me to tell you?
Talking about Iqbal's thoughts reminds us of the familiar thoughts as his central train of thought. We hear Iqbal saying, to a mullah, a denier of God is an unbeliever. To me, more unbeliever is he who denies his own self.
Just ask, what is Iqbal's philosophy? The answer is, the philosophy of your own. Iqbal's philosophy is in fact the philosophy of one's own, or familiar philosophy. What is familiar philosophy? That you know your origin very well.
Never in my life have I been interested in the world's wealth or posts. I built this very house just to accept my wife's repeated requests. My wife's fate in this house had a different form. Here became a safe place for those in search of their identity. I clearly saw that most Muslims in the motherland had lost their Islamic identity, and to regain it, they need to struggle hard. The house, Quiet Corner, became a place for those who wish to fly thoughts of self-belief, something much needed by all.
The house originally belonged to my father, Javed Iqbal. The house title deed had already been issued to my grandmother. Upon the death of my grandmother, the deed was transferred to my father. Allama Iqbal would live here as my father's tenant. He paid the rent to my father every month or every 3 months.
Never did I lose my interest in my native land's people. My best time was when I was among people to see them struggle hard to earn their living. I was inspired by their uproar in the Anarkli district. Loftier than the heavens is the station of man, and the beginning of education is respect for man.
Iqbal lays heavy emphasis on the familiar secrets and mysteries of rapture. Familiarity, as seen by Gnostics, means to entertain the self, to fully know the self. It's a famous statement that knowing the self is meant knowing God. Iqbal emphasized, first and foremost, returning to the self. Search within yourself in order to know the self.
Iqbal invites us to know ourselves before doing anything else. Anything else. We shall heighten ourselves to become a human being, par excellence.
From God's own being, the self got a being so. From God's own show, to self he gave a show. About this shining pearl, I know not where. It could be then without a river there.
Iqbal meant to look carefully at human beings on the one hand and to look carefully at Islamic ideology on the other hand. For that very reason, we see Iqbal describing in detail the Eastern society and the essence of Islamic thought.
Who is a selected man? A selected man is the one who is searched for by God. He is in a form desired by God. God wants that kind of human being. This is possible only if man searches for himself, to train himself in a desirable way, to maintain the self, to try hard to fully understand the self. This way finally leads to knowing well the Supreme Being.
The greatest message of Iqbal, as expressed in his poems, is to know yourself, to turn to your own self, to know the East, not the West.
signs of going senile can be seen very easily in me. The tick-tock of the clock shows clearly the passage of my life. So quickly pass opportunities. So little time have I...